This week's episode was brought to you by one of our favorite podcasts here at The Whole Rabbit, Cryptic Chronicles, available at crypticchroniclespodcast.com, and the support of listeners like you. If you also enjoy The Whole Rabbit and would like to help support our intrepid bunch of esoteric enthusiasts, please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where a $5 monthly donation not only gets you all of our extended episodes and access to our Discord server, but for a limited time, you'll also receive a rare holographic bonus sticker, in addition to our 5x5 vinyl sticker of our cover art sent directly to you at no additional cost. On this week's episode, we explain the much-ignored occult symbolism that garnishes the blood-soaked romance-revenge-horror thriller Mandy, starring Nicolas Cage. If you thought there was something deeper going on beneath the surface of this film but couldn't find any Mandy Explained videos addressing it, you've come to the right place. We explore how Mandy is revealed as the Aeonic Babylon, the overt references to Kabbalah, Gematria, esoteric religion, and even the clip-off. Thank you, and enjoy the show.
Kind of funny because in one of the Tony Stark in one of the Iron Man movies is wearing the same shirt that Mandy's wearing, and Galactus being kind of relevant makes it like this meta MCU.
Wait, he does?
Yeah, there's he's wearing a Black Sabbath shirt from what is that, Never Say Die album?
Iron Man was based off of the song.
Yeah, but it's not on that album, which is kind of funny, but he's wearing a Black Sabbath shirt, so it's like double meta. We're opening portals here now. Iron Man is wearing a Black Sabbath shirt in one of the fucking Disney movies. It's the same one that Mandy's wearing in the movie. And then in Mandy, he's talking about Galactus, and Iron Man fought Galactus. So in my head, it makes like this canon universe, metaverse thing. Oh God, not that word.
Hello everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just advertise that we're explaining Mandy, only to give you a character and plot synopsis you could have created yourself without the audibly pleasant shit-eating grin it takes to power through explaining a film where you entirely ignore the obvious esoteric symbolism. Anyone who's listened to King Crimson or had even a passing interest in metal or fantasy may have easily noticed. Nay, we pull out the dusty Kabbalistic tombs, vials of thulemic sex fluid, and prepare for a journey into the cliff-off, because this week, we're explaining the esoteric symbolism of Panos Cosmatos' revenge film masterpiece, Mandy.
What?
It's pronounced Tomes. That's why I changed the spelling.
Tomes?
Tomes!
Tomes!
Yeah.
Oh.
Come peruse my tome.
I'm your host, Nicolas Cage. I'm actually Luke Madrid, the Hack Rabbit. I'm joined this week by the show's co-host, Mari Sama, the Mary Satan of Cenocephaly.
I'm Nicolas Cage.
Darth Dingus, the imperial figurehead with a crown sewn together of human hands.
You know what's cool about that one? That actually makes me a Crimson King.
Melkor V, the fifth incarnation of Kraft, ready to transcend the ninth paradigm. Kiflon, brother.
Kiflon, brother.
And Heka Astra, the swift-handed weaver of infernal intricacies.
Hello.
All hail Heka Astra.
All right, I have to open up something. This movie starts with Starless by King Crimson. It's one of my favorite songs ever, and everybody who is listening to this podcast should listen to King Crimson, and if it's not to your taste, well, you're just stupid.
The only bad thing about having that song at the beginning of this movie is that they don't play the whole goddamn thing. They only play a part of it. It's a 12-minute song, and it's great.
It's really good.
I feel like you have to hear the whole thing, and I even had someone, like, proselytize this song to me while I was in college, and I'm like, yeah, I'm just not into music. And they literally cried in front of me. Shit, I should actually probably listen to this. And yes, it is extremely profound.
They're one of my favorite bands ever. Like, they have so many just incredible songs and albums and a couple of terrible ones. Yeah, I don't know. I had to plug them. I went to see them live and it was fucking funny because all old as fuck. They're all like 70-year-old Englishmen at this point. And this was right after the pandemic. And if I can remember it exactly, the announcer went, "The world has changed very much since COVID, but music remains hope to us all." And then this decrepit, crypt-keeping man with a microphone says, "Hot balls of rock and roll fury!"
Yeah!
This sounds like a Tool show, but with fish and chips.
Yeah. Well, this sounds like a better Tool show.
Fuck Tool.
Anima's a great record.
Listening to the interviews about Mandy, it was suggested that Mandy was a tale of tension between different generations, like the old fogies and the new cool people. But I found that there was something much deeper going on in Mandy. And as somebody who's not familiar with the discography or definitely hasn't seen King Crimson live, is it safe to suggest there are occult and esoteric themes in King Crimson's music?
Yes.
I've thought as much, but I really haven't looked into it. I know that, okay, Lark's Tongues and Aspic has a whole sun and moon motif. I think there's also some material on the original King Crimson record. For one, he's doing both the sign of a best blessing, like something similar to the Hierophant.
Well,
but he's also holding out his hand open, expecting to receive something.
Just in the name, who is Queen Crimson then?
Well, a Crimson King is a king in a time of war.
Yeah, but who's the Red Queen, though?
Morrigan.
Oh, Babylon.
Babylon.
So in the same way that music is so complicated that I'll flunk out of an introductory class, film is also complicated, but it's made of symbolism instead of notes. Although there is music in film as well, and that can be part of the symbolism. And if you were a top dollar movie maker with a huge ability, genius, and imagination,
like David Lynch
or Panos Cosmatos,
yeah,
using occult symbolism and mythology is just part of your craft. So we're going to go into some depth about the symbolism here. And if anyone thinks we're losing our minds and going too far, there are plenty of other videos that you can watch that explain like the psychological and the thematic content of the film while avoiding the esoteric symbolism, which is pretty abundant in the movie, to be fair. It's everywhere. There's religious and occult symbolism fucking everywhere, and that's to be expected because it's also everywhere in metal and in progressive music. If you're going to talk about like Rush and King Crimson and
Black Sabbath.
Rush, the second bit, I can't say that anymore, but they'll always be in my top five.
Oh, for prog rock, they're like the first wheel that spun it.
That's King Crimson, man. I'm sorry. They came out in 69 within the court of the Crimson King.
Yeah, arguably.
Oh, man,
yeah.
I don't even know if it's arguable.
No,
I mean,
for each
you
of
could
our
say...
statements, it's arguable okay. that they're all the right. first wheels. Yeah, because you're right. You're absolutely right.
Okay, I don't want to be... I've outed myself as a prog nerd, so now I'm one of the cringe kings on this podcast, too.
Yeah.
If we're going to be talking about the end, I just want to say one of my favorite villain deaths in any movie.
There are spoilers in this podcast. If you don't want spoilers or people yelling, yeah, just move on now.
If you don't want spoilers, go and watch Mandy, then come back.
Yeah, because we don't take anything that we talk about on this podcast serious at all.
Never, no, especially not when it possibly pertains to the Travis Scott incident. And
which
people ask
matter.
Us about it in the live chat on our YouTube premieres, which you should check out. We had a whole 20 people in there today.
I got a boner during it.
I did too.
Just saying.
Mandy was made by director Panos Cosmatos and was scored by Johan Johansson, earning a pitifully unfair $1.4 million at the box office. A fucking crime, considering how good the film is. It stars Nicolas Cage.
$1.4 million? Holy shit. I'm sorry, just...
Was that even enough to pay Nicolas Cage?
Well, that's like because of the whole streaming age of things and the new paradigm.
Yeah, because when it came out, it did seem like everybody was talking about Mandy. I know it dropped on streaming fairly quickly. After that, Color Out of Space came out with Nick Cage, too.
I really think it is a shame because like this movie is really fucking good. And that's not that much.
You know what else is cool about it? It's a quiet action movie.
Oh, yeah. It's like... probably like 3 pages of fucking dialogue. I might be exaggerating, but
yeah,
it's very
I really
short.
Enjoy that part because I hate jump scares. I think they're cheap and they're ineffective. And also, if you crowd the scene with gore and you don't use it effectively to the storytelling, it's not effective for me. I think it's gratuitous.
Yeah, the opening
crowded with gore.
The opening really sets a cool tone too. It's all like space and like visually, it's pleasant and the music's great.
They pepper it nicely. Like it's a spicy, gory movie. but they know when to put it in. And I really appreciated that.
I've worked in the film industry for like a long time doing leather work. And one thing I've noticed is like when I was working on set, there's nothing that they do that isn't without a purpose. And when I was sitting and watching Mandy and taking notes, it's really clear, like as I was taking notes, it became really clear to me that like every single thing is put there for a reason. Like every use of color, every bit of dialogue, like that, it's all chosen on purpose, and we're going to kind of like deconstruct what all of that is.
Now that we're through talking about King Crimson.
But that we'll bring it back up.
I think what you said is really important to like, if you want to be like us, quote unquote, and just be able to look at a form of media and analyze it, is that yes, in movies, in music that is mastered in Hollywood and edited in, you know, master studios and stuff like that, every single thing you see for the most part is done with like some intention behind it.
Being on set, I've watched the director like stop and they'll have like a quick meeting just based on like a slight change of the lines or like where they want to move the light to. Every single thing is deliberate. It's something that... They'll have like hour-long meetings. They'll just stop production and have like an hour-long meeting to decide on like one specific thing to make sure that it's right. So when you're watching movies and you want to look at the symbolism, it's important, I think, to realize that they do that. And the people who are, like, making movies heavy with symbolism, you can guarantee, like, Pan Cosmatos obviously chose a lot of deliberate symbolism in this. And so you can be pretty certain that he chose the stuff that we're going to talk about for probably the reasons that we're going to explain.
Did they load Alec Baldwin's gun on purpose?
That should have never happened in film.
Like Baldwin, it wants to talk shit, but he should have known to look at the chamber before he did that whatever stunt. The producer said he was not supposed to even shoot or point the gun in the scene that they were filming. So he did that ad lib to be funny. Yeah,
the official explanation is that he was training a cross draw for another shot.
It doesn't matter. Those should have never been on set. Like all of the, I've worked a lot with the props people because I do that weird spot between props and costumes. And so I've worked a lot with the prop masters on sets and stuff. And every single person in props pretty much has to have a gun license and know all the gun safety. There are no live rounds unless they actually need a live round. They go through very, very strenuous.
Like you can use a blank and it looks the same on film.
There's red tape is what you're saying, right, Hekka?
There is literally no way that you can have this kind of fuck up. So that's why it's such like, how the fuck did this happen situation.
I think somebody wanted her dead.
I think it's obvious, and it kind of speaks to this like Hollywood mafia kind of thing. It's really scary if you think about
it
too much.
It's Yog Sothoth.
I think in this movie, Nicolas Cage really is kind of like fighting a force that's very similar to that kind of vibe that we might be dealing with in our real life.
It's entrenched corruption, and
yeah. And it's got magic behind it too. It's not just like fucking with you on the physical plane.
So on the surface, it's just Nicolas Cage going on blood-soaked caper of revenge against a cult of hippies who've wronged his girlfriend, Andrea Riseborough. But underneath the surface, it's a Kabbalistic journey both up the Tree of Life and down the Tree of Death. To get us started, I think we should look at the most obvious symbolism that it throws in your face, and that's the 44 on Red's favorite shirt. We see both of them wear it throughout the film, in fact. As we explained in our previous episode, there are 72 demons of the Lamegaton, which are ruled over or opposed by 72 angels. These 72 angels are generated from what is known as the Shema Farash, meaning the explicit name, describing a hidden name of God in Kabbalah, including Christian and Hermetic variants. In some of the more mainstream Jewish discourses, it exists as well. It is derived from Exodus 14:19 through 21. Read
bustrephedonically. It's basically like when something is written and alternating from left to right, and then right to left, and then left to right, and then right to left, from line to line. So it kind of like snakes down.
And it produces 72 names of three letters. Kabbalist legend states that the 72-fold name was used by Moses to cross the Red Sea, and that it could grant later holy men the power to cast out demons, heal the sick, prevent natural disasters, and even kill enemies. Likewise, the 44th name of God in the Shema Farash means sweetening judgment, and it's pronounced Yod Lamed Hey.
It reminds me of those people like calculating the end of the world from Bible numbers.
In Kabbalah or even the Hebrew texts, there's a number reading system. What is that called?
Gematria.
Which operates off of the fact that each Hebrew letter has a Hebrew number associated with it.
The Hebrew number 40, for example, is symbolized by the Hebrew letter Mem final and means water. So that suggests might, massiveness, manyness, or plurality and chaos like the deep ocean. And it also means to come from water. So in the movie, during the camping scene at Crystal Lake, we see Red looking on to Mandy with wonder as she rises from the water during a night of camping.
You're so beautiful, baby. I'm Nicolas Cage.
It's here we first see that Mandy, like David Bowie, suffers from a sort of anascorsia, which causes one eye to dilate abnormally large. So there's something off about her when she's coming out of the lake to him. In this scene, Mandy's right eye is fully dilated, and her pupils dilate to let in more light to receive more information, right? So you can see in the dark, and she comes out of the lake and she stands naked before him, and he sees her naked for who she is. So
she's the lady of the lake.
Yeah, I mean that's obviously
Crystal Lake. I think it's a Camp Crystal Lake, right, where Jason like drowned or whatever.
Oh my gosh,
it's a throwback to,
you're right, yeah. She comes out and she looks off. The dilation of her right eye would suggest a lunar and solar eye, as Horus of the ancient Egyptian pantheon was said to have. It's a symbol of her enlightenment, which is evident to Red, who looks upon her with total awe as she rises out of the lake.
This reference to Horus. So Horus's right eye is the eye of Ra, the sun god, and his left eye is the eye of Horus, or the eye of Thoth, which represents the moon. So Horus is a sky god encompassing both the sun and the moon. So his eye of Ra, which is the right eye, Mandy's eye of Ra, is completely open to let in all of the light, all of the information that she can. And so she's this open receptacle to the divine light.
She's kind of like the center of this guy's world.
Yeah, Red's not the only one who sees it either. In the scene where Jeremiah sees her on the roadside, her right eye is also fully dilated in that scene.
And I think there's a very hidden message onto why this is the case, is because if you look at Mandy's name, the origins of her name, it means lovable one.
Oh.
Pretty much all who look at her are going to fall to that spell. I think it's very clearly done with her
name. Which makes it even worse when they wrap her up in a sleeping bag and light her on fire in front of them.
Yeah, it's horrible. And I see some like phoenix symbolism there too with the character of Red, but we'll get there.
She lives on, you know, her fucking reaction actually permeates, and that's why she's put to death.
Okay. It reminds me of the Phoenix Force from Marvel.
Besides the 40, we have the 4, which is symbolized by Daleth, which means door, and it's associated with Venus. It suggests a path, a way of life, a movement into or out of something. Venus was known as Lucifer to the ancients. An association well known in occultism today as Lucifer falls after the sun, yet after some time being reborn as its harbinger, bringer of light, which was represented in various ancient mythologies concerning a beautiful, sensual warrior goddess descending into the underworld to redeem the light. Perhaps most notably, Inanna and Ishtar, who later became the Phoenician Astarte and the Greek Aphrodite, Persephone, Demeter, and eventually even Alice in Wonderland, until she gets her shit kicked in by Tweedledee and Tweedledum, and they take her
bag of crumpets.
She definitely seems like she's been around too. She's got a scar on her eye. She's
also middle-aged.
You know, they hit her with all the poisons, and she just laughs. She straight up laughs in front of like what turned people like us into little babies when we see the extra-dimensional elves and stuff, and when we're getting high. She's like, "This isn't my first time, dude," and she's kind of enjoying it at some point.
She laughed at the cult leader's dick,
which is great.
And he went,
"Stop laughing at me."
And he just stared at her and had the dick out, and she keeps laughing at him in his wee member.
Most importantly, pertaining to Mandy, who could also be understood as being Inanna, Astarte, or, you know, the esoteric equivalent of Babylon, which transcends like a bunch of different cultures all over the world. They have always carried the title of Queen of Heaven, the abode of the stars, which are swiftly taken away from Red. leaving him starless. So the song is just, this is why they have it at the beginning. It's what's about to happen.
It's also interesting because I think he was named Red because the album that Starless came off of was Red by King Crimson. When the cult leader had somebody fetch Mandy for him, he said, I feel naked without her.
Oh, yeah, we'll get to that. We'll definitely get to that.
It reminds me of like Buffalo Bill kind of guy.
He also did the same pose as the famous painting, the Death of Marat, which I started reading about but didn't finish. So I couldn't tell you the symbolism, but it's the same pose.
So we have the 40 and the 4 together, understood as two numbers, but together, the number 44. It's also related to the appearances of Jesus in the Bible, more specifically his crucifixion, as a period between Christ's crucifixion and his ascension was 44 days.
Then, if you go over to Liber 44, the Mass of the Phoenix, it's an official Eucharistic ritual within Thelema and the AA, written by Aleister Crowley. It first appeared in the 1913 Book of Lies. This ritual involves making a small laceration on the bare chest. This is an alchemical reference to a fable wherein a pelican pierces its own breast to feed its young with blood. In the Mass of the Phoenix ritual, one cake of light is burned, while second is held to the breast to be anointed with blood before being consumed by the practitioner. The ritual concludes triumphantly. Abrahadabra!
Abrahadabra!
I entered with woe, with mirth. I now go forth and with thanksgiving to do my pleasure on the earth. Among the legions of the living, he go forth. A claim is made to having integrated this mystic state of consciousness at the end of the film by the protagonist and the antagonist during their final show-off, which is mainly verbal. The psychotic drowns where the mystic swims. Besides a reference to this water as 40 and Daleth, the goddess, 4, a more important connection is that 44, when they're put together, Daleth and Mem in the Hebrew language, it means blood.
Whoa.
This is an important motif in both good horror revenge flicks and the Western esoteric tradition concerning its most prominent figure besides Christ, Babylon, who in the Thelemic tradition is said to be drunk on the blood of the saints, or more importantly, whose veins flow with the same passion for life which drove the saints to seek God.
On the idea that Red's shirt with the 44 being important, Mandy also wears it because from that point on he's wearing the tiger shirt, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
It's important what they're wearing on the shirt, and specifically Mandy when, what is it, a Jeremiah Sand, when he sees Mandy for the first time on the dirt road out there, she's wearing a Black Sabbath shirt. Anyway, it has a Triforce on it, and it's a symbol that has mathematical concepts.
Sabbath.
It's also a fractal.
Like, so he could have put like Sabbath Bloody Sabbath shirt on it if he wanted to just be brutal, but he chose a shirt, I think, because it has a symbol on it that we should be paying attention to, just like we should be paying attention to the 44. He didn't choose any old shirt. It's called the Serpinski Triangle. It's a bunch of math stuff if you want to go into that.
They're also equilateral triangles.
As what we were saying in the previous episodes, triangles have a lot of importance across all cultures. They're like, quote unquote, strongest symbol. We use them in bridges, which is symbolic in itself. We use a minimal amount of material items to achieve what we shouldn't be able to make a big giant bridge. We use the empty spaces to like hold the structure up.
Symbol is defined by the empty space in the middle as well. If it didn't have that, it would just be a fucking triangle.
It comes down to structural integrity, and the equilateral triangle, all sides are supportive of each other for the minimum amount of sides that it can have. That's the reason why it's used in bridge construction, is because it takes the least amount of materials and it is the most supportive.
It's using things and no things, if you get what I'm saying. It's using non-material items and material items together to achieve a balance and
the balance
transcend the function or the material nature of the items.
It flows where it's directed instead of through the entire object.
It's such a wonderful symbol. If you look into Eastern mysticism, you see this triangle in whatever culture, look into what the hell they're talking about, because as it happens to be a fact, there are three triangles on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, and it's also got the negative Tree of Life shown in it too. Specifically, I can see that the Triforce, at least as it's in The Legend of Zelda and like as we normally see it, it's like the top of the Tree of Life, and it's might be like just the hero's journey, and it's how to turn a boy into a man. And I think that's the what happens to Red as a character. He is one of these aspects on the triangle if you're looking at it as a Triforce.
I like what you said about the triangle being represented in the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, and if you look at the Black Sabbath t-shirt, you'll notice that, like, if you're familiar with the Triforce, it's usually like you've got the three yellow triangles and the one black. black in the middle, and Mandy's shirt, which is the Black Sabbath shirt, has it inverted, which to me is like if you invert the Kabbalistic tree of life, you end up with the Klifoth. But we will go into that a little bit later on as well. It's but I think that's a direct reference to the Klifoth as well.
It's just the hero's journey, basically, is what I'm saying. It's just right there on you. And that's why the movie's named after her. It's so in your face. It's like...
It's also inverted. The Klifoth is the inverted tree of life, correct?
Yeah, that's what I was
saying. It's not inverted on her shirt. It's the right side up.
The whole point is to envelop both aspects at the same time.
It has all of them contained within it, because it's infinite triangles on top of triangles, inside triangles, forever and ever, all the way through.
A fractal.
Yeah, it's a fractal mathematical idea. It's got Kabbalistic ideas. It's the hero's journey. It's just the Eastern idea of it.
The Sierpinski triangle on Mandy's shirt, it's the colors that are inverted, not the triangle itself that are inverted.
Yes, true. So you're absolutely right. That is the Klifothic trip right there. Totally.
It is a hermetic yin-yang, because the Kabbalistic tree of life can be understood to be the Trinity repeated three times, or three total, right? So you have the first trinity, and it's reflected down once and then again, and then you have the world of matter, which hangs below it. That's what you could put in the center of the triangle, and that would be like the material realm that sits in the middle of the sacred realm. But it's also, like you guys said, the gateway to the other side of the tree of life. And it's a yin yang in the sense that the tree of life is rooted in the tree of death.
Yes.
It's supported like a bridge. The negative space has a function. There's a reason why there's negative space under the bridge. You can't weigh that much, and it won't hold itself up if it weighs too much. So you can't take that trip and solely function in that negativeness. Because if you do, all you're going to do is just make the whole positive part of the structure like functionally better.
It's guided by the positive. It's structured by the positive.
So it's as you can see, it just folds into itself and it keeps going. It's on her shirt in negative colors for a really cool reason. It's on purpose.
It's placed on the skull, correct?
Oh, no, it is on the skull. You're right.
The tree of life existing within oneself, perhaps even inside of one's mind.
Absolutely. Yes, because, number three is the mind. Like in the previous episode, we were talking about the five and the six. Five is the man. The three is the mind. In the ancient psychology.
It relates to the Trinity, because once you've crossed the abyss, you have those three spheres left.
Three fucking triangles, yeah.
And it's a state of consciousness that's not bound to your ego. It's now universal. So it's understood that this Trinitarian consciousness pervades everything, like an ocean, which relates it back to the number 40. And in so much as 40 is an ocean, that was considered like a bestial, chaotic force. And the reason she's rising out of it is because she is, as the higher self, rising up out of the lower self. And she's symbolic of that angelic nature, where red is symbolic of the water or the chaos, and it's the relationship together that the shirt 44 symbolizes.
And that's why I think they both wear it in the film.
So it has a lot of different meanings. Mandy is Red's everything, as she unfortunately will descend into the underworld halfway through the film. She's the Inanna figure, or the Queen of Heaven, who completes her journey by reviving the light of the sun, who in this case is Red. Mandy is portrayed as Red's Queen of Heaven early in the film during their conversation regarding planets, who symbolically are within her. Her favorite planet is Jupiter, a gas giant used to symbolize the sphere of Chesed on the Kabbalistic tree of life, whose color blue like the day sky, to which Jupiter or Zeus presided, sometimes in the aspect of Janus, the hunter god king, who dies and is reborn by the queen of night, Jaina or Diana. This was later transformed into Christ and the Virgin Mary, who, like Diana, rules over virgins, childbirth, the ocean, death, and resurrection of the king, and still portrayed as standing upon a moon to which Artemis, Diana, was a goddess of. This is portrayed in the film by Red's nightmare. The moon is also, of course, symbolic of dreams, as Mandy is happening upon a sacrificial deer in the grove before Red wakes up afright.
Upon waking, Mandy tells a story from her childhood about starlings. Starlings are another reference to stars, and the killing of stars recalls the opening song Starless by King Crimson. One day, while playing with friends, Mandy's father collects the baby starlings in a pillowcase using a crowbar to pound a baby starling deep into the dirt before passing around the crowbar to the other children to do the same. When it was her turn, she ran away.
It was her choice.
I don't remember this. I wish I did. as a side note, that is totally like some shit that you would hear some 40-year-old man, 40-year-old woman out in the sticks say that their parents did to discipline them. The further away you get, the more bizarre these punishments can get. You know, the further away you get from prying on.
Here we have like another reference to Starless. We've got the starlings being killed. And I thought it was really interesting that the choice of starlings as well, because they're considered an invasive species, which I believe represents the necessity of Red's rampage against their cult invaders. Because they're invasive. Starlings are sometimes also used to symbolize angels in religious iconography. On the Tree of Life, each planetary sphere has a correspondent angel. So it would make sense that Red as Galactus would go about eating them.
So the cherry upon which the starlings feast is symbolic of purity, prosperity, renewal, evolution, and ephemeral beauty. Taken together, we might assume a Gnostic perspective represented in the film, to which the angels, quote unquote, are seen as malevolent, invasive, unwanted, and predatory personifications of fate, to which the Gnostic seeks refuge in Christ or the Sophia to nullify the effect of the forces sometimes known as archons or controllers, manipulative and negative manipulative entities.
Little demiurges.
Exactly. And to the Gnostics, the creator god who ruled over these planetary archons was a blind, absurd, and stupid tyrant who believed that all creation was his to dispose of as he willed it. And he fed on the indwelling light of humanity while demanding the utter obedience of them unto him.
I love it when H.P. Lovecraft is real.
I mean, very good. That's a really good comparison.
That sounds just like Azathoth, except without specifically acknowledging humans.
Well, yeah.
Azathoth technically doesn't know that anything exists, but it's all his fault.
Yeah, because H.P. Lovecraft knew some stuff. And that's the beautiful thing about the etymology of the word Sophia. Sophia means knowledge. And where we wisdom. Get philosopher is got Sophia in there.
Philosophy.
So that's love of knowledge.
I just want to point this out, though. To anybody who's had intense existential anxiety or depression, like, you know, maybe all of us have.
Yeah.
It's not such a stretch to come up with a blind, dumb god.
Absolutely. That's my whole point across the show.
It may be that he knew it, but it came from his musing on the nature of the world.
Because this is the whole rabbit, I have to bring up the Timaeus every show. And if you go and read the Timaeus, it starts out with like all these wise men explaining how, like, if you're bad, you'll reincarnate as a beast. And if you're really bad, you'll reincarnate as a woman. And they have all these really stupid ideas. And then by the time you get to the part where they're talking about God, they're like,
well, this is Demiurge. He created this crappy world. And, well, I guess he wanted what's best for us.
So it makes sense that at some point somebody came along and was like, that's tyrannical and stupid. This place sucks. So, and what do we learn in the last episode? That witches have melancholy? So, yeah.
The melancholy thing directly ties into, I think, this next part. Sophia, being knowledge, turns out it's actually a feminine thing.
Well, she doesn't consent, and that's why she's put to death, which is kind of fucked up.
Mandy's artwork, shown early in the film, depicts several subjects. A woman on an eagle, a wolf with many eyes, and very notably, a woman in red with a lion.
The woman in Mandy's artwork is wearing red and is depicted with a lion.
Rippy. A very direct representation of Babylon, depicted in the strength card on the Thoth Tarot, which links Mars to Jupiter on its way up the tree along the path known as Teth, or Hebrew for serpent, the original symbol of kingship in ancient Egypt. This is another reason why Jupiter would be Mandy's favorite planet. Her path on the tarot leads there. The scene where Mandy is walking down the road is saturated in red hues. Yeah, it's very trippy. The red fog hues of Babylon, pretty much, all around here. And then these headlights emerge from an inverted red triangle or cup of sky. Jeremiah Sand has to remove his sunglasses to look at her to see just how brilliantly she shines. So he recognizes her. He's got something going on. He's one of the pieces on the triangle, I think, definitely in the movie.
Oh, it must be them religious folk next door. Bless their heart.
Esoterically, Babylon is the divine lover. The sexual mysteries symbolized in Western alchemy, as well as in Hindu Tantra, are reflected monstrously, diluted, and even excluded in Christianity. In Christian tradition, the same wisdom is carefully hidden in none other than the symbol of the Holy Grail, which does not directly give recognition to the sacred feminine until you look much closer and dig. In the case of Indiana Jones, literally, the skewing of the divine lover into a being with negative connotations, as informed by Hebraic Christianity, is again reflected in the Children of the New Dawn, who quite frankly are a lot like the Children of the Old Dawn. Christianity has been terribly successful in dismantling and reducing the beauty of the divine lover Babylon to a negative effect. The leader of the cult does exactly that when he describes her simply as a whore. John Dee and Edward Kelly were equally emasculated and frightened by her power when she spoke to them during their works as the Daughter of Fortitude, saying the following:
I am the Daughter of Fortitude, and ravished every hour from my youth. For behold, I am understanding, and science dwelleth in me, and the heavens oppress me. They cover and desire me with infinite appetites. Few or none that are earthly have embraced me, for I am shadowed with the circle of the sun, and covered with morning clouds. My feet are swifter than the winds, and my hands are sweeter than the morning dew. My garments are from the beginning, and my dwelling places in myself. The lion knoweth not where I walk, neither do the beast of the field understand me. I am deflowered and yet a virgin. I sanctify and am not sanctified. Happy is he that embraceth me. For in the night season I am sweet, and in the day full of pleasure.
I just picture Luke sitting next to her with like a pointed stick, like a pencil or some shit.
He's
jabbing
got like
it
the
into
mic.
Her ribs lightly. Read the page.
He's got the mic, like, and I'm, like, trying to look over the mic, and all I can see is, like, the bunny tail-looking thing of the mic, and, like,
so pretty.
The words were highlighted, and I couldn't see it properly.
It's so pretty. I identify with that.
I really love that passage.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, I'm, like, wiping the tears out of my eyes as I'm supposed to read this next one.
I mean...
No crying on the whole rabbit. No, rabbits don't cry.
No crying in the whole
no
rabbit.
Crying on the
There's
whole
no
rabbit.
Crying in the whole
There's
rabbit.
No, there's no crying in the whole rabbit.
Anyway.
Get back to work.
This red woman, she is the Holy Grail, the chalice, the divinity of the womb filled with love so potent it might be called the blood of the saints. She is the gateway to the city of the pyramids, the Scarlet Woman, and my great mother.
And as Crowley wrote in his Book of the Thoth,
Book of the Thoth.
Book of
Sorry.
The
Thoth.
Let's keep I'm it sorry. That way.
So as Crowley wrote in his Book of Thoth, she rides astride the beast. In her left hand, she holds the reins, representing the passion which unites them. In her right, she holds aloft the cup, the Holy Grail, aflame with love and death. In this cup are mingled the elements of the sacrament of the aeon. And likewise, Mandy works at a gas station, and she literally is the fuel to Red's fire. Even from the underworld, his soul ascends up the tree, eating each planet as he goes. So he's consuming energy.
Holy shit.
So she actually, she deals in energy.
You
so,
know what's funny about that? I have to get this out there. Okay, so he's red and he's getting larger and he's consuming outer planets, right? When
yeah.
a star runs out of fuel and dies, it has a high probability of becoming a red giant.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Or a brown dwarf, depending on what's white. Available.
Yeah, brown
or
a
white dwarf.
Black
or a black
holes.
Hole.
Or a black yeah. hole if he's, there's a lot of energy.
It's all there in the movie.
I really love this movie.
Yeah, it's really fucking good.
It's so cookie cutter. Like when you have like this eye to see the occult and like all the symbolism, it's like easy. It's like, oh shit.
The visuals are just amazing.
It's like an acid trip in the same sense that Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is like an acid trip shot that way.
Here's the thing is that I'm actually more affected by visuals. It adds to the fucking dialogue. So when the old woman comes to the gas station that Mandy works at, and she actually talks to Bandy behind the counter, her purchase comes to a total of $5. In the scene, you can also see the American flags hanging behind, like behind Mandy in the gas station. They actually don't have any stars in the blue field.
Yeah, they're like hanging in a way that you can't see any of the stars.
Out of focus just enough, so it's just like there's no stars there.
Like, it's just a flag. It doesn't really represent all of the different states.
It's another reference to Starless. Like, this is like another shout-out.
Starless.
So Babylon's consort is Chaos, like we mentioned, having a relationship to the number 40 in the 44 equation. Chaos in Thelema is called the father of life, and is referred to this way in the Gnostic Mass, being the male form of the creative principle, portrayed as the solar lion, 666. Babylon is usually depicted as riding astride this beast, drunk with the passion of the saints. The union of the two energies of masculine fire and feminine water is described as androgynous when combined in Tantra, but because of their sexual nature, is usually associated with the Vama Marga, the left-hand path, and Gnostic Satanism in the West, existing in opposition to the religious symbolism of the dominant culture, in this case, Christianity. For example, in Gnosticism, the serpent, or Nasash, is equivalent to the Messiah, which have the same Hebrew numerical equivalents of 3, 5, 8. As such, to the Gnostic, the path of Christ is also the path of the serpent, who in the Kabbalistic tradition ascends the tree, eating or integrating each sphere as it evolves towards the Godhead. The film references this directly as he dons a vest bearing prominently the sigil of Lucifer during the initiation of his ascent up the tree as he kills each planet one by one.
You're saying Jesus equals the snake?
Yes, in Gnostic cosmogony, Lucifer does equal the snake. Furthermore, the strength card or the lust card has Teth as its Hebrew letter, which also means serpent. So they're repeating this.
Christ.
Yeah, they're repeating these themes over and over and over. Like we're barely into the movie still.
We got to go down to the Bible Belt and tell these people about this.
Yeah.
So we.
Hey, you don't have to go down there. Mario and I can just do it tomorrow.
Yeah, we'll proselytize for you.
Yeah, we're gonna go get a megaphone and
can we make anti-chick tracks?
Yeah.
We should make some for the whole rabbit.
Yeah. Yes.
But the punchlines are always so fucking obscure that you have to look it up just to figure out what it's about.
But this whole serpent symbolism is on her. She's reading a book, right? What's it called?
It's actually called The Seeker of the Serpent's Eye. I know I wrote kiss in the notes, but it's eye. So that's the book that Mandy is reading. And she reads it out loud in the film. It says, "Under the crimson primordial sky, surrounded by the jagged rocks of the ancient volcanic mountain, the wretched warlock reached into the dark embrace of the fissure until his hand touched a smooth, glassy surface. Cold as ice, his fist closed around the serpent's eye. Slowly he withdrew it and held it before him in the fading light of the blood-red suns. It glowed from within, a ghostly emerald light, strange and eternal."
I hope to someday be addressed as a wretched warlock on frequent occasions.
I mean, I would call you that.
That's why they don't shower, and they just grow their beards out and have mange and shit. They're like, oh, this guy's a fucking dirty wizard. Get him out of here.
Dingus the wretched warlock.
That's
wretched warlock and dirty wizard are two wretched. Totally different things.
Yeah, because if you're a dirty wizard, you're just self-neglectful. If you are a wretched warlock, unlimited power! That was fun.
We've got this direct serpent imagery and symbolism going on in the film. The rising serpent is like the liberating savior.
Lucifer rising.
Yes.
The serpent with the knowledge of good and evil, able to see with its eyes the divine light's true nature. Red makes his way up the tree as a winding serpent of Kundalini rising with the heat of love's flame. The passion spoken of Babylon, fueled by the sacred lover, Mandy. He uses Saturnian energy to consume the spheres on his way up. He does mention first that that's his favorite planet, but because people don't know Saturnian mythology, which is another thing Mandy tells the audience they should look into, he decides to go with Galactus instead.
Guy in the chat who thought Kronos wasn't associated with Satan or Saturn.
Yeah, that's do your research. If I can say one thing about what you just said,
go ahead.
Remember, look at Mandy, her name, origins. It means something to love. So,
bueno Dios.
Kundalini, Red using it to get him to that place.
Because the Kundalini is activated from the lower chakra, which is your sexual organ.
Right. She's the heart of love's flame.
You unite with someone in that way, a lot of times it will awaken your Kundalini.
Ever come and it shoots way up your back through the top of your head. Kundalini.
It's crazy.
Not the jizz. I just mean like the field.
No, the energy actually. No, it's true.
You ever
true.
Jizz out the top of your head? Kundalini.
Emotionally, yes.
I don't want to talk about it, though.
Kundalini, the fucking motion of it goes in a circle. It goes down, up, and then up through the female, and then down through the male, and then out at the bottom. And then, yes, it creates a circuit. It's beautiful.
That's why in ritual you breathe through your butthole.
Exactly.
I'm buying the astral realm for sure. Like that energy, yeah. I'll take it. I'll take it in the butt.
That's my shit, my man.
I'm so buying the real realm.
So we've got this symbolism of the serpent rising, and we've got Mandy's book, The Seeker of the Serpent's Eye.
The serpent's eye sees the true love of Babylon. As we can see in one animated dream of Red's, she raises the emerald eye of the serpent, the emerald stone from Lucifer's crown, out of the wounded beast and raises it up high. I find this interesting because the emerald is associated with Taurus. Of course, Taurus itself is ruled by Venus and is associated with earthly pleasures. We see that she is how he connects to Babylon's love in a scene at the end, where Mandy is shown in an emerald hue. The emerald eye of the serpent is the absolute perception and completion of this timeless love and enlightened understanding. It is a well-known myth that the Holy Grail is, of course, forged from the emerald of Lucifer's crown, imparting immortality, a faint acknowledgement of the holy force of the divine feminine within the mystic Christian tradition. The serpent's eye glows emerald because his inner eye is always transfixed upon his inner grail. Mandy, who glows emerald in his vision of her smoking a cigarette at the end of the movie, two planets hanging above next to a rising sun. Emerald is also interesting here because naturally green is the opposite color of red, so it stands out very much. And of course, red is associated with Babylon, the number 8, the sphere of Hod, and then green is associated with 7, Netzach, victory. So aside from Lucifer, the serpent red is also the beast, or the solar lion, 666, which has been tamed by the queen of heaven as represented in the strength or lust card of the tarot, Babylon, while Venus, the queen of heaven as portrayed in the lust and the empress card, is dressed in white, symbolized by the shield bearing the white swan. The beast lion is red. He is the emperor and his shield bearing the phoenix. So in a sense, red is literally King Crimson. He's also the one committing most of the murder. So he's a Crimson King, which, as we've covered already, is a term used to name kings in wartime. While we might relate the stars of heaven and their 5 points to our higher nature, guided by love, philosophy, beauty, and other things, we can easily relate to our angelic side and the good things in life, clothed in starry white, symbolized by the loving swans coming together. The red lion is our bestial, lustful, and wrathful nature, which burns itself up only to arise again in the eternal cycle of life related to the 6 or the solar bird phoenix. The two combine as 11, which is once again associated with the strength card of the tarot, which shows this relationship. Likewise to Abrahadabra, the magic phrase of the phoenix ritual, which is an 11-part formulae derived from this creative fusion here described. Mandy is the angel, Red the beast. Together they create the magic formulae of all creation, and in her, all powers are given.
Now ye shall know that the chosen priest and apostle of infinite space is the prince priest, the beast. And in his woman, called the Scarlet Woman, is all power given. They shall gather my children into their fold. They shall bring the glory of the stars into the hearts of men. For he is ever a sun, and she a moon. But to him is the winged secret flame, and to her the stooping starlight. My number is 11, as all their numbers who are of us. The 5-pointed star, with a circle in the middle, and the circle is red. My color is black to the blind, but the blue and gold are seen of the seeing. Also, I have a secret glory for them that love me.
I'll show them my tits.
That's Babylon.
Pretty right? much.
Well, that's what scared John D and Kelly. They're like, oh, tits! And they had to chill out for a minute because they were saying their prayers and trying to not think
about
it.
Because they lived in Victorian England and they had to go dab the sweat off of their brow as they awaited for their erection to stop pressing an imprint in their pants.
So while the antagonist of the film, they call Mandy so dark a whore that she burns as brightly as she does, but Cage sees her differently and he sees like auras of light around her. I think that might be a reference to what we just read.
Yeah, he sees a holy light. And aside from the conjunction of angel and beast, Venus and sun, there's a similar relationship between their two favorite planets. Mandy's is Jupiter and Red's is Saturn. So they're pretty much almost antagonists or opposites, but they work together in a certain way. The 11 is returned because Jupiter is the fifth planet, while Saturn is the sixth. Plus six obviously is 11. So they're opposing. It's not 10 exactly. It's 10 plus one. So there's kind of a tension between it that sparks the relationship and the fire. And likewise, Jupiter is also related to the merciful aspect of kingship, moral law, humanistic philosophy, and charity. Saturn, his father, is associated with the devourer, the harvester, death, limitation of all that is bound in time, so also a time god, and resembling on a higher octave the relationship between man's law and God's law, the six. So that's the thing, is that there's man's law, which the five-pointed star, which we discussed, and then God's law, which is the six-pointed star, which, interestingly enough, Saturn's northern pole is actually shaped as a hexagram.
Or so hexagon.
Yeah.
Well, also,
It also has the star inside of it, but yeah, the shape.
It's a hexagon. He's right.
Yeah, no, I'm just.
What?
I'm
same
just,
thing.
It is the same thing to me, and I'm just.
To me, I saw the 6 points. When the first time I saw that picture, I was in awe.
Me too. My mind was fucking blown, dude.
I find this really cool.
I thought it was Saturn that had the hexagon.
It is.
Okay.
I was just going to say, I thought it was interesting because Jupiter is usually associated with like the merciful king and like human moral law. And then Saturn is just like, everybody dies, bro.
You know what else is interesting about the color of the hexagon?
What? It's purple.
It's damn nearly black.
No, that's the bottom. There's like an eye of providence on the South Pole, and it looks like a big black eye.
I didn't know that.
Malkuth.
I didn't see that until like a few days ago. It blew my mind.
You gotta post that in the Discord.
So Red saying his favorite planet is Saturn is, yeah, definitely he's death.
Exactly.
He goes on his killing spree in the second half of the movie.
I see the Reaper fast approaching.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
She knows death. She knows that is in Red, and that's kind of like why she's in love with them, maybe.
Yeah, she likes the red storm in Jupiter. As Dingus said, the Red King is a king in wartime, and Jupiter is considered a peacetime king. But in the Kabbalah, of course, the severity comes out of Chesed. Likewise, we can see that as symbolic of the severity that slumbers inside of the peaceful king that she loves.
This actually makes a lot of sense to something that I didn't understand in the movie for the longest time, which is after these events, when Nicolas Cage goes to retrieve a crossbow, which he had a name for.
His crossbow is named the Reaper.
Oh, shit.
Sick.
So it's all
kinda,
in your
face. Kind of Punisher, Scully, but I don't know. If you actually have murdered multiple people, the Punisher skull is a little less cringe.
Oh, so and like, you know, there's an archetype in the man who has all that weapons, all those weapons for him, and the special arrows. This movie's full of archetypes.
Yeah, hey, we're going to talk about that in a bit, I think.
Quick call out, I'm sorry. To the man who I was stuck behind in traffic for 5 minutes the other day, who had 6 Punisher skulls on his car, which was a Jeep Wrangler, including one with a blue stripe down the middle that says, I got your 6. You don't have anybody's fucking 6, pal.
You were behind him? You were behind him.
You weighed 300 pounds. Yeah.
You had his 6.
Okay, but he didn't have anybody else's 6. He was in front.
Okay, so we've got Red's favorite planet, he first says is Saturn, and then he says he changes his mind and it's Galactus. So, who is Galactus?
Oh, isn't he like a fucking Marvel villain or something?
Yeah.
Galactus.
He's really old.
Is he that guy that's just a large head on a chair? Is that him? Is that somebody else?
No, Galactus is this giant, huge, godlike being. I had to Google it because I don't do comic books or superheroes?
Yeah, he's like a very ancient entity that is the destructive force of nature that's necessary for, in the name of balance. And he just likes to consume planets for energy, and it's Saturn.
The chemist, he says to Red,
"You exude a cosmic darkness."
And then he allows him to pass.
Which I think is a reference to his Saturnian nature, because that's what Saturn does. It exudes a cosmic darkness. And in that part of the film, he's about to cross the abyss and go up to the higher realms towards the planet in the northernmost section of the sky, which of course would be Saturn. He's meeting with his shadow and his destiny. Saturn is just the more esoteric version of Galactus. This movie is so generous with trying to pass out its symbolism that it's saying, okay, if you won't look up the mythology of Saturn, how about you just know the mythology of Galactus? If you're somebody that is supposedly into 80s era motifs, don't you know about Galactus? Who, according to the Marvel Universe, is the first and oldest living entity in the universe. Galactus was created during the union of the sentience of the previous universe and Galen of Ta, and is described as the physical metamorphosed embodiment of a cosmos. Galactus was originally an explorer, Galen, of the planet Ta, which existed in the prime pre-Big Bang universe. When an unknown cosmic cataclysm gradually begins to kill off all other life in the universe, Galen and other survivors leave Ta on a spacecraft but are engulfed in the Big Crunch. Galen, however, does not die. After bonding with the sentience of the universe, he changes and gestates for billions of years in an egg made of the debris of his ship that the current universe formed after the Big Bang. He emerges as Galactus. Although not an abstract, non-corporeal deity, his true form cannot be perceived by most beings. Each species sees Galactus in a form that they can comprehend, similar to their race or deity of their religion. So in our mythology, we would have perceived Galactus as Saturn. Galactus can also appear as a humanoid star when addressing fellow members of the cosmic hierarchy. Through his actions of consuming planets, Galactus embodies a living force of nature whose existence is necessary to correct the imbalances between the conceptual entities, eternity, and death, who are characters in the Marvel Universe, as well as to serve as a cosmic test for survival for civilizations. Additionally, the continued existence of Galactus ensures the confinement of the cosmic entity, Abraxas. As Galactus requires planets with the potential to support life, his existence also causes the extinction of entire extraterrestrial civilizations, just like the Reaper in Mass Effect.
Yeah.
It's like a fanboy. He looks like a like an angel almost.
I wish I was.
No, he's nowhere near like the esoteric. He's nowhere near the esoteric description of Rooster Guy.
But he is mentioned in the film. So it's not clear if they're referencing Abraxas of our reality or Abraxas of the Marvel reality. Or Abraxas of some weird Lovecraft reality.
If you're wondering where they referenced it in the film, it's the horn of Abraxas to summon those black skull guys. That's where the name Abraxas comes up in the film.
And it looks like the fucking Ocarina of Time.
It totally does.
So oh!
Triforce.
Oh!
Absolutely.
All of Ocarina of Time was essentially a story about Link losing his childhood in order to save the world.
Yeah, it's the same story.
And when he got it back, it was still broken.
The original Zelda game, one of the original dungeons, if you were to put all the, like a map layout of it, it looks like a swastika.
Nice.
Oh, yeah, but Black that Sun. Meant something different.
No, it does. It does mean something different.
Well, I mean, it meant, okay, yeah.
It maybe blurred out that word, the S word there, but
yeah. We all know the highest power in Legend of Zelda are the chickens. Maybe that's why.
Oh my god, more Abraxas. More.
Nintendo is fucked up for not letting me wanton murder in my video game.
I fear the chickens.
As you should.
Dude, they're scary as hell.
I think Panos Cosmatos is like a huge nerd and a huge occult nerd. And I think that he was like, okay, well, like if people don't know who like Abraxas is, then maybe they'll know who like Marvel Abraxas is, because like he's, you know, that's a bit more pop culture reference. So he's trying to use like this symbolism, and he's using pop culture symbolism to do it. Super nerdcore. Yeah,
really, like this movie is just cherry picking on the basket of like, what do nerds like? Just put it on camera and get it done. Because the whole second half at the 1 hour mark, movie's exactly 2 hours long, pretty much. It shifts to the second half of the movie where it's just a killing spree going down the cliff off.
Killing spree.
And if you'd like to hear us talk about the 10 Sphere of the Cliffoth, who is Abraxas in historical mythology, and the tainted blade of the Pale Knight, and who the heck gives him his crossbow, and what it all has to do with the Tree of Life and the Black Sun, please go to www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your donation of $5 keeps us doing this show every week as long as our voices are able. Thank you, everybody. Eat carrots and shoot lasers.